Hi, I'm Richard Elan. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. This is going to be really fast, and as a result, you may want to talk to me afterwards. What we're going to talk about is how to do radio drama using voiceover IP, or what I've called radio drama at a distance. And these are the things we're going to talk about very, very quickly. So the technology, sound equipment, set up, how to set things up, how to plan sessions, which is actually one of the most important bits, really. The technology, it's one of these things where it's not the technology, it's what you do with it that's interesting. I got into this through an organization, an outfit called Radio Real Players, and we're a group of Second Life residents, and we were interested in doing some Shakespeare for a project which was happening last year, a grant-funded project called Shakespeare in SL. And we wanted to do some excerpts from Shakespeare for the three plays that we were doing for the presentation, and we had people all over the world, so the real question was, how could we do it? The obvious solution would be to use Second Life Voice, which is, as we're in Second Life, it has this voice thing. It's actually the second most popular voice over IP application in the world. Unfortunately, we didn't find it reliable enough. It would produce all sorts of weird audio effects, and as well as the audio itself being location dependent, so when people moved in different places, you got variations in sound level and stuff, made it very difficult to control. And the audio quality was really quite variable. Very often you get a lot of echoes and bizarre feedback effects, which weren't just a matter of people having loudspeakers that ended up picking up other people's microphones. And we found we had a lot of trouble using the private voice chat channels, which just didn't seem to work very well. So we looked instead at voice over IP, and the obvious thing to use was Skype, although there's plenty of other options. It's a known technology. Most people are acquainted with it. You can go and download the thing for nothing, get online in a few minutes, and it's only mono, unfortunately, so if you want to do stereo, you've got to do it in the post-production phase. And there are latency issues. In other words, there are delays because of digital processing, and you have to get around those in post-production as well. And there can be quality issues, particularly as far as things like how many people are on the call and what the paths are like and whether people have the right ports open or not. So what we're really talking about here is a well-known technology which we're using for an unusual purpose. But you can do lots with it. I also do an in-world TV show every week, and we use Skype for the audio for that. Even though we're actually doing it in Second Life, we could use Second Life Voice. We much prefer to use Skype because we get more reliable results. And yes, you can use any old VoIP application that everybody you're involved with has got. So there's plenty of possibilities with that. Skype is just an example. Now then, production tips. Here's what we're going to look at here. My personal view is that you shouldn't use a headset. I do know a couple of people who found particularly brilliant headsets. But by and large, the microphones are usually rubbish. And the microphone is very close to your mouth, so you tend to get pops. There's little techniques you can use, like sticking the mic boom over your nose and things like that. But that tends to drop the level and you lose top end. So I'm not a huge fan of them. We have found this particular one model useful, but it's not really the way to go, in my view. But definitely you need to use headphones. Absolutely, certainly. Don't ever have stuff coming out loudspeakers. What I would recommend is a condenser mic. And this one pictured is actually a very nice USB condenser mic. You can plug it straight into a computer. Works straight away. And they're surprisingly not a huge amount more expensive than a good headset would be. So we're talking about the difference between, let's say, £40 and £60 in this country. As far as recording is concerned, you may well be able to work this out for yourself completely, but here's just some tips about how to get audio into your system. It really depends on how you're set up. I use Macintosh and Windows platforms, and it's actually, curiously enough, a little bit more trouble in Macintosh than it is with the others, but I use a thing called Audio Hijack, which gets the audio in perfectly adequately. And then as far as editing is concerned, then obviously Audacity you may be familiar with if you're into doing audio work. as a free application, which is extremely nice. I actually use a thing called DSP Quattro on the Macintosh or Adobe Audition on Windows. Audition is actually a really nice application for this. It's what I generally work in. We use both the recording and editing capability, but also the multi-track capability when putting the whole thing together. My view personally is that the person with the most audio experience should be in charge of recording everything and originating the call. And you do actually need to have a certain degree of trust in your group to make sure that actually works for you. Luckily, my lot trust me, which is great. So I get to record everything, which means I have far more work than anybody else. But it's really good fun, actually. And the person who's doing the recording should originate the call. That's fairly important. We've discovered this over a large number of attempts, really, that the people who originate the call get the best results. And what you're doing is you're doing a conference call in Skype, and the person recording should start the call and call everybody up. And before you actually start recording, obviously make sure that the audio... Sorry, I'm in a bad position. I'm a little bit limited by where I can be. And so obviously, yeah, try it out first. Make sure you've got decent audio quality. If you don't get decent audio quality, drop the call, start again, and usually you'll find it'll work. As far as maximizing call quality is concerned, there's plenty of documentation online, both in Skype's own site and if you do searches based on things like Skype call quality, you'll find tons of information. But the main things to note are to open the right ports. I haven't put those in this presentation. They're easily located. There is a really good place where you can find this information, and it's in the Skype FAQ for broadcast and film. Skype has actually introduced recently some interesting terms and conditions for broadcasters using Skype, which are about credits that they want, and they want audio credits every 15 minutes and logo credits on video and stuff. And I only noticed this the other day when I was putting this presentation together. And we're going to have to take notice of that one because I didn't see that before. But anyway, Skype have plenty of information on how to debug call quality, how to get a big panel of information about the call quality and what to look for and what ports you need to open and what you should be looking for in terms of the transport protocols that are being used. In my view, the technology bit is easy. It's really straightforward. It's known technology. And you're not doing anything terribly funny with it. The difficult bit is actually planning the sessions. I strongly believe in having a stage manager who actually organizes everybody, makes sure the right people are available at the right time, makes sure that the right people are available for the right scenes. And what we've found best is to create the equivalent of a shooting script, where we've actually got all the scenes that involve the same people together, and we can just bash through them with the same people on the call, only having the people who you... need on the call. In other words, minimize the number of people who are actually on the call, and because the quality seems to be better if you have a smaller number of people in a conference call. So the fundamental thing there is to organize the segments that you're recording so they've got the same people in them, so you can do them all at the same time, which means you're not going to record them in order. So you need to ident them properly to make sure you can find them later, which is fairly straightforward. This bit is probably a waste of time, because if anybody's doing drama, they'll know this sort of thing already. But I was working with people who hadn't done this before ever, so I came up with a list of small things, which are here, and give you an idea of how to approach things, and just to make sure that when you've got edit sections, you have as much as possible to cover the edit, and everything will be behaving itself, and you'll be able to cut out duff bits and put in correct bits, which will sound as if they were done at the time, which is the obvious idea. I did mention latency earlier. It's worth talking about because it's a major and significant issue. And I do live TV shows using Skype audio, and it's a real pain because my colleague will say something, and I've got the script in front of me. I jump straight in, and it sounds to me as if I've really nipped on the end of their speech. But in fact, there's going to be a pause of half a second or something, depending on where everybody is. I work with a TV company that's in Australia, for example, and I should think the latency is quite significant, almost more significant than you could possibly imagine anywhere else. So what you will have to do is to tighten up the pauses in the post-production phase. So it's an editing job, and you will always have to do it, absolutely always. Needless to say, this is sort of standard editing stuff, but as I say, I don't know how many people of you have actually tried or are interested in doing drama for radio, but if you are audio people, you know all this stuff. If, on the other hand, you're drama people, you might not know all this stuff. So this is all pretty straightforward. I do believe in making decisions as you go along. One of the things that we got into in the multi-track studio environment years ago, when we went from 16-track to 24-track, is suddenly you went from the position of only having one track left to do anything on, and you had to make decisions about whether they could do a better take or not. And suddenly you had 8 tracks you could do that on, and you could say, oh, let's sort it out in the mix. Well, let's not sort it out in the mix. Actually do it at the time. Really, quite honestly, make decisions at the time. Don't put them off, because it just otherwise loads the post-production phase with so much work that it's a real pain in the backside. Sticking things together. I use Audition, as I was saying. I run all the bits up into a multi-track session. Nice thing about that is that you can chop up the dialogue. If you want to pan people, you can usually chop them up sufficiently. Particularly if you do that before you've taken the latency out, it's even easier, because you can just move the panning about. But ideally, bring the dialogue into a multi-track session. Then you can also stick your other stuff in, like effects. And that's a source for really nice free sound effects, which don't have any royalty problems. Freesound.org. Definitely recommend them. And then you will obviously want to put breaks in the dialogue and move everything about so you can insert music and effects and what have you. And talking of music, we should mention very briefly copyright. When it comes to the actual works you perform, your actual dramatic works, then they should be either your own or things in the public domain. We do stuff in the public domain. We've done bits of Shakespeare. We've done E.F. Benson ghost stories. We've done Christmas Carol. We are working on Pride and Prejudice, and we're doing a Victorian melodrama currently. So they're all nicely out of copyright. But equally, I'm hoping that there's plenty of people out there who would like to do modern stuff that's their own stuff and want to do some experimental drama and things like that. And this is a wonderful medium for doing that, because it really doesn't matter where you are in the world. Don't use commercial music. Really, honestly, don't use commercial music. It's not worth it, because you have to get much more licensing together than if you're either using your own music or, on the other hand, royalty-free so-called ho-ho. Just buy it and use it music. Or I would say library music. Library music offers extraordinarily good quality stuff. If you're going to broadcast the things in terms of, if it's on a streaming radio station in this country, you want a limited online exploitation license in general. But that's all you need. If you're playing commercial music in a production, then you will also need things like PPL licensing and other stuff. And it starts to get very messy very quickly. My personal view would be do your own music. Well, don't do any music. Do your own music. Use royalty-free so-called music, they're the easiest options. And then if you want really high-quality music, the best place to go is a production music library like KPM or DeWolf or one of those people. But bear in mind that you will need a PRS license, but you don't need anything more than a PRS license. And that is about it from me, which is just as well, because I've only got a minute and a half left. That's what you get for 15-minute presentations. Just for your amusement, we did the 3 excerpts. I've actually mentioned these things, so I can whiz through them. That's what we're up to at the moment, and that's really it from me. That's a little picture of the assembled multitude in Second Life, having done Christmas Carol. We found this location in World where they had all these Christmassy things, and so we posed outside Scrooge and Marley. That one's me. I'm actually Elric Merlin in World. If you've seen me on Twitter, that's my name in Twitter as well. Thank you very much indeed. If you want to know more about this, do chat to me afterwards, and thank you very much indeed.
OK, Okay, this gives me a chance to do the same joke I did earlier. The archaeology is not the antique I've got in front of me. There we go. Okay, that is bright, isn't it? Crikey, it is slower than I remember. There we go. So, the history of the microcomputer between those dates. Those dates are actually important. This is kind of when I was first aware of proper computers, you know, those that you switched on and they booted up immediately, you didn't have to load font for 27 hours, those that you could load things or program straight away without doing anything. These were good computers, microcomputers of the real day, real stuff, and I'd like to talk about them for 15 minutes or so. I'd like to talk about them. Unfortunately, they're all dead. All the computers are dead. All the software is dead. They're on tapes that have been disintegrating. When you can load them in, it then says, please enter the word on page 7, line 4. I don't happen to have that manual anymore. I'm not sure where it is exactly. So we can't actually use any of the software, and the computers are dying. So actually, that's it, end of talk. There are no computers. Nothing ever happened in the 80s. Okay, let's have another go. So, digital archaeology of the microcomputer. Let's see what we can actually find. What's left? Is there anything left? Yeah, there is. You know, certain things, you know. This is one of these, you know, little... If you're the journalist and you want to take away, this is one of these little things that you have. I could read it out, but you can read it yourself. You know, we won't be able to study the history because the history will have been lost. Not particularly through any fault of our own, but just stuff happens, you know. It's dying, isn't it? My heart, I mean, I do actually have computers from, you know, back in the 70s and the 80s, and they are pretty much all dead. Would you actually believe that back in the day, computers had an aerial socket on the back? Not a VGA socket, not a composite video, an aerial. We're going over to digital and cable TV now. You know, I've probably got the last TV on the planet that actually has an aerial socket. We wouldn't even be able to plug the things into the telly anymore. So, you know, it doesn't matter. Even if we do work out how to load the stupid things off a tape. You remember cassette tapes, those little things that went round and round, and if you don't get the volume and tone exactly right, it will never load, and you spend there looking at the screen for 20 minutes? Yeah, we won't be able to see it anyway. So it doesn't matter. So, there you go. This is the line that, you know, journalists and Twitters like to do. It's not that no innovation took place, it's just it won't be recorded. The same happened way back in history. The Dark Ages, not known because there was no light bulbs, or though obviously there were no light bulbs in the Dark Ages, but it was that no technology took place. Apparently, of course technology took place. People always invent stuff. But it wasn't recorded. It wasn't noted down. It wasn't remembered. So apparently nothing ever happened. And that's exactly what's going to be happening with, I think it's going to be happening with the computers from 70s and 80s and possibly even the 90s. So what do we do? It's a 10-point plan because everything's a 10-point plan. If you don't have 10 points, obviously you haven't thought about it enough. So we have a 10-point plan how we can save all of our wonderful heritage. Because I think it is wonderful. I like computers. Well, except this one. So, step one, keep the old ROM image. You remember, you know, back in the day when the operating system did not come on a disk and you actually had it built in the silicon? Yeah, get that out, rip it out, store it somewhere, use it. Amstrad were actually quite good at this. When Amstrad bought Sinclair, back in, 87, something like that, they actually said, we know you're doing emulators and we don't really mind, so if you're doing it, you can have the ROM. Keep it alive. And that was like, that's good, that's useful. Other companies that are still going would still actually like to sue you for using the ROM. Like you could buy it anyway. It's fine. And old school programmers, of which I am one, and we are actually quite bad. You know, nowadays, us programmers use things called APIs. If you want to access the operating system, do it in this way. Except if you were born in the 70s or 80s, in which case you'd poke a memory location and instantly your disk would start working, or the tape would write out some bytes. Poking memory locations is bad, but it did kind of work. Unfortunately, that means you need exact emulation if you're ever going to do this, and you need the original ROMs. There is a new ROM, a patched ROM of the Sinclair Spectrum, which is great, but it means some games won't work because it's not a byte-for-byte copy. It's not enough to have the same API. It's got to be the exact same hardware. So ROM is good. Audio structure. I mentioned cassette tapes, so this bit is kind of self-explanatory. If anyone remembers that big song from the 1980s when I really hope that's not being recorded. That's going to come out so great on the tape. You remember the really teeny whiny sort of notes that sort of oscillated between two frequencies or so? Well, I think sometimes there were two frequencies, sometimes there were more, sometimes the format had a block, sometimes you could retry a block, sometimes the frequency would change slightly. Tapes, they have wow and flutter on them, and they change the frequency slightly. So you've actually got to say what these frequencies are, what the pitches are, how it's being used. Even this one, BASIC, I'm sure some people here have programmed in BASIC. Some people here probably still do. A machine code. On a number of systems, you had a different load command and a different file format on the tape if it was a BASIC program or it's a machine code program. It's not a block of data anymore. It's a specific loading format for a specific program. And some programmers were very, very clever. They said, I don't want my software being stolen, so I'll save it at double speed on the tape. Well, that's fine if you've already got the system running, but if you haven't, you can't load it because you need the system in memory to load the system you can't load anymore, sort of thing. So you can't even load it. So it needs to be documented. You need to say that this game is, you know, Jet Set Willy, for example, this is a Spectrum loading, and this is how the Spectrum does its loading. Because otherwise you'll never know. And if you don't say it's a Spectrum game, you're not going to know. If, you know, 5 years' time, beep, 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 I'll do it again, there you go. No one's going to know what program that is. No one's, you know, okay, some of us can probably work out by the sound of particular things that this is a... Okay, I've found the geeks in the audience. Some can tell, oh, that's a 16K Spectrum program, that one. I can actually tell that the header is 125 bytes, yes. But not me, obviously, because I'm normal. I'll tell you when I'm doing the jokes, okay? Right, so we've got the tapes. We can use them, we'll record them, we'll sample them in, but please, not in MP3. I know it's lossy and it is quite good, but... disk space is so cheap. You're not going to save that much by losing information. Why would you want to lose information? You don't need to lose information. One of the few things my science teachers actually taught me is when you do an experiment, we normally had to write things in the back of the book. We did this, we made this and that. And they said, well, don't draw your results in the back in rough and copy it out. Why would you want to copy it? You're losing information. You might get errors in that copying. Do it properly first time around. So recording it properly, obviously remote backups, we all know that stuff. What else did I say? Oh, yeah, and document the format you're using it in, you know, because otherwise we have the same problem. We have some data, but we don't know what it is. So, document the software. So, Jet Set Willy was the example I gave earlier. Just say what it is. It's very simple. It's, you know, if you are a librarian, if you've been a librarian, or you've got that sort of mentality, document everything. 16K Spectrum or 48K Spectrum. The poor kids had the 16K version. The rich kids had the 48K version. They were both good machines, but you could sit there for half an hour and work out why it wasn't loading, only to find out, oh, it's a 48K version Spectrum. Okay, this game's not going to load in my 16K. Again, the memory model is actually important for some machines, but unless it's documented, who's to ever know? Language, again, that's the basic machine code thing or whatever. And how you load it, because some people wrote their own custom bootloaders and they wrote special pieces of code for copy protection, or they saved the file without its header on so you could not load it normally. And there's only 5 people in the world that actually knew how these loading systems work. One was the guy that wrote it, and the other 4 were the people that cracked it so they could actually play it again properly. That's 5. That's not many. And these were 5 people back in the day. How many of them do you reckon are still around, actually interested in it, and would probably want to do it again? Not many. So, network aware... Oh. This is the dull corporate, let's use CMS systems. Yeah, of course, well, whatever. You know, just keep it available. And remotely as well. This is for anyone that's used the old PlayStation Linux kit. It needed a Syncon Green monitor. I couldn't find one when there was Syncon Green monitors, let alone now. I'm sure they exist, so don't get me wrong. Also, this is a slide which I can't actually do. If I'm, you know, giving this talk in America, I get stopped at customs and thrown out the country because they have a problem with this. 4th word on the manual, Jet Set Willy. I'm sure I've used that as a good example because I like it, and Matthew Smith is an absolute idiot, and I love the guy so dearly. He came up to me. There's a retro conference down in Croydon, and he just burst through the door going, "Wah!" He goes, "Well, the door said entrance." No, that's entrance. And this was 9 o'clock in the morning, so I have no idea where he's got his beer from, but obviously good stuff. So that was a complete deviation. I have no idea. So, Jet Set Willy, yes. Their copy protection system was a little card that had colours on it. And you have to go to page 1, page 2, page 3, page 4, row 4, column 6, or something like that, and it would be a 4-colour bar, red, green, blue, and orange or something. Which was fine if you had it, but guess which part of the system you actually lost first. Is it the cassette tape? Is it the actual inlay? Or is it this little tiny piece of card with colours on it? I'll tell you which one gets lost first in my house. And I'll also tell you that colour photocopiers didn't come in until much later. You can't even store this stuff. I know people, and I'm not one of them, that wrote it down by hand, every colour, just so they could play the game. I mean, use it. No, I didn't say that. That's why I'm not allowed in America. So, free software emulator, free software. Free software is good. I like open source. And why is this important? Well, I've got some emulators, and they all run on DOS. Unfortunately, my computers don't run on DOS. Even DOSBox isn't quite good enough to run a lot of the old emulators. Okay, the emulators were written badly, and maybe that means... Actually, if the emulators were written so badly they don't scale up to modern CPUs and they relied on the clock cycle being exactly this, then perhaps it's not important enough. But I'm not so important to say this is an important machine to save. I think, well, let's save everything, let's save as much as we can, and we'll let the rest of history decide what was actually quite good. Latest since... Oh, I'm a slide ahead of myself now. There we go. And free software tools as well, because free software is good. Did I mention that? Yes, good. Oh, yes, I've even mentioned that bit about coaxing CPU-dependent code. I really hate the people that just program said, oh, I know exactly how long this instruction takes. Well, not in 10 years you won't know how long that instruction takes. So all the emulators are broke. And don't use, keep everything. I mean, disk space is so cheap. Keep everything that's actually possible. I mean, I've done some conversions. I was a Dragon 32 person, as well as being a Spectrum and Jet Set Willy fan. There's a set of tools that you can convert the audio files into direct binaries for the Snapshot emulators, so it just loads straight in. Unfortunately, one of the tools has a slight bug which works on some of the programs and not others. I didn't realize this until I'd broken half the thing, so keep all versions of everything, and document it as well. Document it, I like documentation. It's just like sex. When it's there, it's fantastic. When it's not there, well, it's better than nothing, isn't it, really? So did I say that one out loud? Better not. Okay, so this is the source chain. This is pretty much everything in one slide because, okay, I only did have a 9-point plan and I just used the last point to do everything again. The source chain is essentially everything from the original software running on, you know, on a cassette tape or whatever to running in an emulator at the final build. Every single step you have a chance of losing something. You can lose information. Bits can go missing, quite literally bits can go missing. You can lose information, you put it in various file formats, but keeping the chain as pure as possible, limiting the things that you use, don't keep saying, oh, I'll convert this down, I'll convert this. Keep every part of the chain, make sure it's all available, have as little loss as possible, and, okay, maybe we don't have a use for old games from 1982, but someone would, and someone would like to see them at some point. Oh, and documentation, please, so we actually know what we're doing. But not in Microsoft Word. Thank you.
We come from the video production side of it rather than the technology side of it. So we're really looking for some technologists to come and help us out.
Okay, this is actually, I'm a bit ill at the minute, so it's talking to be very dynamic. That training day, so it's a bit of introduction. So we've got a foundation grant, we produce a lot of content, we syndicate content from all around the world. So we've got a lot of very high quality video, and we want to distribute it now so people can watch it using open source tools. So we're using Miro, which is a downloadable client, which allows you to actually watch video via torrents, RSS torrents, so you can actually. So you've got full screen, broadcast quality video. We've got a CMS called Liferay, which is a really interesting project. It allows you to take any part of the CMS and take an embed code and embed it on any other website. So our TV channel, you can just rip parts of it out and build your own TV channel. So, you know, what we really want people to take the project, we're bringing all the great resources into one place. We want them to take those resources and do something useful with them. Because at the moment, almost nobody sees this podcast. And it's really interesting stuff about people trying to make the world a better place. All this inspiring stories, so we'd love it to be used to. Currently we're doing 5 channels. Grassroots UK, sort of environmental direct action, Friendly Fire, US stories, global fuses, the rest of the world. The reason we have the US as one channel is because we can have more content coming out of the US than anywhere else. Head mixes culture, counterculture, soap operas, music videos, etc. Fun-based technology, social change. So So. So I'm just going to show you a brief film. This is the Pulling the Minds out of the Open Video Conference out of New York, and this is a film produced talking about open video and the do's and don'ts.
Hi, we're here at the Open Video Conference in New York. By 2013, 90% of all internet traffic will be video. And the vision on TV, we want to enable citizen journalists and filmmakers for social change to participate fully in that revolution. So here at the Open Video Conference, we've been asking the experienced people here how to set up an open video project. What should you do and what should you not do?
I would definitely not look into how should I prevent people from watching my content. I think it seems like there is a lot of effort going into not allowing people to get the content in different places, which I think is counterproductive for everybody.
Well, I wouldn't create a walled garden. I wouldn't want to try to hold everything in, and I wouldn't want to keep my users locked into a relationship. I think it's about if the content needs to breed and live on its own.
Launch another show that features a female talking head reading headlines in front of a green screen. There's a lot of those.
I would not overly script video presentations. I would not act as, hey, this is Andy Plesser, and today we're going to talk. You know, it's just not necessary. People don't need that. You need to be a guide. You don't need to be a sort of a moderator or an interpreter or a host. I think there's some people, like, you know, who are very talented and good-looking and have a great way of presenting material. But I think letting the subject speak is really the most powerful way, if you can do that.
Just try to understand what's television and what's the internet. It's two different medium, and you're creating from the internet, not for television. So that's a big mistake people do when they do an internet video project. They're too much influenced by what they've seen on television, and they forget that they're not bound to do that. So that's what you should not do. We do like television-like.
Trying this whole notion that we went through, I think a lot of people went through a few years ago, of trying to build your own, even open source system. You know, we'll build it, we'll contribute it back to the community. Nice idea, but if there's already something out there that works well, use it and develop for that. So then you're really contributing back to a much bigger community.
I think it's, you know, important to not worry too much about the tools you're using, to not be puritanical, because I've definitely had times where, you know, for a while, I was trying to use all open source stuff for it, but I didn't get a whole lot done because I was spending a lot of time learning the tools. And some of the tools aren't up to snuff.
It's important not to cozy up to those in power, to enjoy the perks of the powerful, to enjoy the access of evil. That's trading truth for access. You know, you go to the prime minister or the president's news conference, you know, if you lob a softball, they're more likely to call on you again. Well, that's not worth it.